I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Seems like it's been a while since any part of town could boast about a drop in crime, but that's exactly what Kansas City's Northeast neighborhood is experiencing this year. Today, we'll explore what led to the reduction and find out how more collaboration between police and community groups led to less crime and a safer neighborhood. Then, Christmas time for kids means stocking stuffers, new gadgets, and don't forget the lit. Our friends from the Johnson County Library are back. They'll share some book suggestions that are sure to absorb your young readers. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With just 1 month of the year left, there has been zero homicides in Kansas City's historic Northeast neighborhood in 2018. And that's saying something because last year there were 11. On top of that, aggravated assaults are down 15% and robberies 20% from 2015. So what's happened? How did Kansas City police find success in this part of the city when success has proven so elusive in so many other parts of town? We're about to find out. With us, Major Greg Volker is the division commander for the East Patrol Division for the Kansas City Police Department. Major, thanks for taking time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Stalder is president of the Indian Mound Neighborhood Association. He also works for Northeast News. Brian, nice to have you.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Andrea Tuthope is here. She's a reporter for KCUR who has covered this story. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning.
Major, so is this reduction of homicides just a coincidence or are you guys just good?
It's not, we're just good, it's the community, the neighborhoods, the individuals living within the community. They wanted to take their neighborhood back and make sure this type of violence, you know, reduced and continues to reduce. It's about the neighborhood.
What did they do?
They begin to work and partner with the law enforcement, tell us exactly who the individuals were who were committing the crimes, where the crimes were being committed, and then developing a constant communication. If there's an issue, we don't know about it, you know, when they call 911. We know about when they call 911 also when they send emails, they make phone calls. They're interactive and they want us to be part of the problem solving.
Brian, is the major seeing things about right from your perspective?
Yes. We wanted to put more infrastructure in place using a mixture of technology, but then just even, you know, good old fashioned, you know, getting to know your neighbor, put that in place so that we can improve communication amongst neighbors and then get that information to law enforcement.
You know, how did you guys approach this issue this year, Major? Because I've heard about these impact squads that you deployed in the area. What are those?
Well, an impact squad is a group of individuals who are basically work as a team to work within the community to solve problems. And their whole objective is to solve problems, not to answer the calls for service. And they work with the intelligence. They meet with me and my command staff. They meet with the community interaction officers, our crime-free multi-housing officers, to find out where the problems are at. And then they go attack those problems.
So clearly they were a factor in this reduction that we've seen in the historic Northeast as well.
They were, as well as No Violence Alliance and the individuals that worked within there. Earlier this year, they partnered up. They began to come in. They came into East Patrol Division, worked to reduce the crime there as well. And then that has been carried over by the officers that work the area. You know, that's the essence of law enforcement is we work 24/7, and we have to be there 24/7.
You know, Andrea Tuthope, again with KCUR, how did you come across this story, this notable decline in homicides in the historic Northeast?
Yeah, so I went to a meeting that was coordinated by COMBAT. That's the county's anti-drug sales tax program that coordinates a lot of the anti-violence groups and efforts in this county. And Vince Ortega, who's the executive director, I had been talking with him. He told me that they were having a meeting about crime in the Northeast. And he, in fact, had been having monthly meetings at Matty Roads, which is kind of like their community resource hub that they've established in that area. And CIO from the KCPD, Greg Smith, gets on the phone and he's sharing with the room that he's noticed a drop in crime. And I followed up with that, got some numbers, and sure enough, there was indeed a drop. So,
Brian, how big of a deal is this for you and your residents up there? I mean, this strikes me as pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as the neighborhood is growing again and people are moving into the community, they want to feel safe. And, you know, it was just a couple of years ago that there were quite a few homicides in the neighborhood. And just, you know, when you hear the gunshots or when you hear about a homicide in your community, it just doesn't make you feel safe.
How unsafe did your neighbors feel up there?
It depends on what part of the neighborhood you were in or maybe how connected people were with the Crime Watch networks. But I would say that there was a general feel of, you know, unnerve. And we dealt with that at our meetings.
People were ill at ease, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah. And
that's
so,
a bad place to be for anybody, isn't it? We say those words just off our tongues, but that's a bad place to be living your life.
Yeah, it can be. And unfortunately, you know, there is a mentality from some people in the neighborhood that have lived there for a long time that it's a place where they don't want to like that they're stuck there, that it's a place that they want to get out of. And that's something that we've really been trying to fight as a neighborhood association, that the neighborhood should be a place where you want to stick around and raise your family. Because I grew up in the neighborhood and I'm raising my family there, and I want more people to feel that.
Do you feel that way now?
I do.
You can raise your family there. You're not worried all the time about what might happen.
Well, I would say that I've more or less consistently felt that. But one of the challenges that I took on when I became president of the neighborhood association was showing other people the part of the neighborhood that I saw or the way that I felt about the neighborhood, and then working together, you know, to really show that to the rest of the city.
You know, Andrea, before we get too far down the road here, maybe we should talk about exactly what neighborhoods we're talking about up in the Northeast.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So this is a very specific geographical boundary. That's a lot of people refer to it as the historic Northeast. So that's Gladstone Boulevard on the north, Prospect on the west, Belmont on the east, and 9th Street on the south.
Mm-hmm.
So that specific area saw 11 homicides last year, zero this year.
And it's a cool neighborhood, isn't it?
It's a cool neighborhood. I mean, something that's really cool about it is that it's a very diverse neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I don't want to continue this conversation without acknowledging that crime and violence disproportionately impact people of color in this city.
Mm.
And I'll be interested to continue looking into the Northeast and really talking to a wide variety of people about how they're experiencing crime there and how they're experiencing this crime drop. Because, you know, it's important to kind of take all of that into consideration.
You know, Major Volker, as you look at this, I'm wondering, how unusual is it for a community to come together the way the historic Northeast did and to come to the department and say, we've got a problem, we want to work with you, we're willing to listen and do what it takes to get our arms around this issue?
It's not unusual at all. It takes strong leaders. It takes strong leaders who, you know, have lived in the community, that want the community to become a place where they can raise their family at.
Mm-hmm.
And we are always open. The previous commander was there, Jim Thomas, as well as Chief Smith, who's also a division commander at East Patrol. We are very open to, you know, if we're not doing something right, we'll change. We'll make sure we do it right. And so, but we have to have that feedback from the community to say, you know, we don't like this or we like this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our job is to enforce the law, but our job is also to work with the community.
How confident were you, Brian, when you went to the police and you said, we want to solve this problem. Things are getting out of hand. We want to deal with this. Were you confident the police would step forward and help you deal with it?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, because
some neighborhoods may not feel that way in this town, so that's why I'm asking.
Sure. I guess, you know, there's always that maybe disconnect or misunderstanding of what the police are capable of. You know, they can't always prevent crime as much as they can respond to crime. And
so
once you've been a victim of crime, it can sometimes be, you know, frustrating to deal with the police in the aftermath of that. And so, you know, we just really wanted to work with our community to sort of have realistic expectations of the police, but also improve our communication with the police department so that maybe we could get better results.
So what did you guys do? What sort of plan did you lay out? And what did you begin to do differently that you hadn't been doing before?
Well, social media was probably the first and easiest, you know, way to bring the community together. You know, just creating a Crime Watch network.
Facebook?
Yeah, that we used primarily Facebook in the beginning to just reach people in the community and kind of create a private or, you know, invite-only group with neighbors to communicate things. Generally more things like if you heard gunshots, where approximately did you hear them and were they reported? Mm-hmm. You know, and some we found that some people weren't comfortable sharing a lot of detailed information because even in a group, a closed group of maybe 200 or 300 people, you don't know how many people in that group might know somebody or something that's going on that they wouldn't want that information or their name tied to that information. Mm-hmm. And then so through that we created private messages that were more targeted to like 2 or 3 block areas, and there was maybe like 2 dozen members in that group at most, and they were all known individuals to other neighbors. And so then through those private messages, we've been able to share more detailed information about maybe specific houses where things were happening and we were observing those things.
So who in the social media circles were actually reaching out to the police and reporting what the neighbors were hearing and seeing?
Well, so in the beginning, it was primarily you know, just board members, like neighborhood association board members. But we really stressed sort of just training the people that were in these messages that, like, you know, when you hear gunshots, try and call the police first and report them, and then you can come back to the Crime Watch group and say you reported it and then share what other information that you might have with right. that. But we really worked on training the people that are part of, like, everybody that's in the group to just call police.
You know, Major, when is reaching out to the police a good thing to do, and when is it overload? I mean, say you have a neighborhood that's on point and a gunshot is fired and 15 people call 911. Does that become a problem or not?
It's not a problem for us, and this is one of the things that our, you know, our very trained call takers and dispatchers, they streamline the information to get right to the officers exactly where they need to go.
Right.
And sometimes when you have 15 people call, it helps to actually triangulate exactly where the shots are coming from.
Ah.
And therefore, we know where to go.
And you can do that sometimes based on the phone calls you're
correct.
Getting.
Exactly. Yeah. If they're saying if we have four individuals saying it happened at one location, it's probably going to be at one location.
Yeah.
And most times we do that. We encourage people to call.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a drop in crime in the historic Northeast neighborhood in Kansas City. If you want to join our conversation by any chance, 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Major Volker, again, what did the people in the Northeast do in terms of reaching out to police that proved to be so helpful? What specific things were they saying to you that you guys were able to latch on to?
Beyond the fact of our community interaction officers going out to the community meetings, being available, giving phone numbers out and say we're available, they constantly are emailing myself and my other command staff as well on issues. It's not just talking to the officers, not just calling 911, but we're actually giving myself, my other commanders, where the problems are at, who may be a problem person and without being specific, and allowing us to do our investigation. That's been the constant. There's not a day goes by that I don't receive information from the community of sometimes it's, we haven't heard anything lately, anything we need to know from you,
mm-hmm.
which is also important as well, is that they're asking for feedback from us. What are we knowing? What do we hear? And so we reach out as well. We reach back to them and say, this is what we know, this is what we've heard, and try and be as transparent as we can.
You know, Brian, what I'm hearing here is that you guys actually developed, you know, real life, human to human relationships with the police department. Does that sound right?
Oh, yeah. They the officers are at every one of our meetings, and then I'll even just run into them in the neighborhood, and, you know, I'll sit down with them, have coffee, and just update them on things that are going on in the community.
You know, Malcolm from the Waldo neighborhood wants to know if demographics in the Northeast have changed recently. He's asking about race, age, income, and has that had an effect at all?
Well, I would say that we are seeing as people are moving back into Northeast, we're seeing maybe more white affluent folks primarily being the ones that are moving in. But if you look at the demographics, it's still, at least the Indian Mound neighborhood is still like 52% Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And then the further west you go through the northeast neighborhoods, like as you get closer to Pendleton Heights, which is closer to downtown, there's a much larger African and refugee population there. Mm-hmm. But no, we're still a very, very diverse neighborhood.
Are there trends in one direction or another, Brian, that may be impactful here?
Trends in terms of
the types of ethnic groups moving into the neighborhood?
No, I'm not aware of any.
Yeah. Okay. You know, Major, I guess the multi-billion dollar question on the table here then is, if the police and the neighborhood can be so effective in Northeast Kansas City, why can't this be replicated elsewhere around the community in the same way, with the same impact that it's had here?
This process, this communication process is replicated. Many, many locations in the city. You know, we're a city of 317 square miles. Our crime is centralized in a very, very small geographic area in there. The high violent crime is a very, very small geographic area. So I actually go to other community meetings and say, what's happening in the Northeast? We want to replicate here. We want you to know that we're here for you and we can communicate back with you.
But is it fair to say you aren't getting the same level of cooperation elsewhere in the city that you are in the Northeast?
From the active members of these communities, we're getting a lot of cooperation. Mm-hmm. It's the people who are not active that are not as cooperative. Those who don't want to come to the meetings, don't want to share information. They want to live in their own house without sharing information. You know, that's what we're seeing that in other neighborhoods where in Indian Mound, if they're not comfortable sharing with us, they'll share it with the neighborhood association, who they can get it to us anonymously.
You know, this notion of social media groups that have sprung up in the Northeast, do you see the same? Is that a tactic? Is that a way forward here that might work in other neighborhoods, or are they already doing it?
A lot of neighborhoods are already doing it.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's the level of involvement from the individuals in these other neighborhoods is lower in locations where you have high violence at.
Yeah,
most of them they don't want to be involved in it.
You know, and yeah, go ahead, Andrea.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that part of the reason, from my own reporting, I think part of the reason we're seeing like the community in the Northeast being engaged is because there's been a concerted effort to get those people to communicate and kind of open up, meet their neighbors, talk with police. You know, that's what I've heard from the CIO community interaction officer. You know, he was telling me that, you know, he gets calls and emails all the time, but it's also because he's going to community meetings.
Yeah.
And, you know, not every officer can do that. You know, we have there are two CIOs per patrol, and that's awesome. It seems like they're doing really great work. But I think what we're seeing specifically in this area is that there's been an effort, a multi-agency effort, to get people to trust law enforcement, to feel free to speak out about what they're seeing and what they think the problems are. And I think that the crime drop is a result of that.
Brian, how difficult was it for you to convince some of your neighbors to, in fact, cooperate and speak up and share information?
Well, I wouldn't say it was necessarily difficult to get people on our side, but it was just reaching them. That took a lot of work. You know, we've hosted National Night Out events in August for the last couple of years, and just brought people out to the park and met them, you know, on the street. Mm-hmm. We've done some canvassing. We've worked with some nonprofits after violence occurred in past years, where we would go and canvass the area around that to kind of let people know that there are resources available and or other ways to share information so that they, you know, maybe feel safe in the wake of, you know, a tragic event that happened on their block.
And Major, just to be clear, though, it sounds like what I'm hearing here is that the level of cooperation in the Northeast is greater than what you see in some crime-ridden neighborhoods.
This is true. That's true.
That remains an issue. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, Andrea, Jackson County Combat started something called a Violence Reduction Initiative. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so that's part of where this sort of focus on the Northeast came from. I think it's Vince Ortega from Combat has been working hard to identify hotspot areas for violent crime. And he obviously works in tandem with the police to identify these areas. So they also have this initiative happening in Independence and Raytown. And that's what's allowed him to go to monthly meetings in the Northeast and Independence, Raytown, to kind of coordinate all these efforts. And I don't want to go any further without mentioning all the other groups that he's bringing together. It's like Kansas City No Violence Alliance, Maddie Rhodes in the Northeast, like I mentioned, Kansas City Public School District. We've got Center for Conflict Resolution and the Prosecutor's Office. I mean, this effort, it seems that you know, depending on whether this works or not, they maybe have a hope to do this in future years in different yeah. areas.
Yeah, Major, just as we begin to wrap up here, is there any doubt in your mind that this model, these efforts we've seen in the Northeast, the community working in tandem with the police department, has had a direct impact on these crime numbers? Homicides down, assaults down, other violent crimes down in the Northeast, or is there still a chance this might just be serendipity here?
Well, there's a, I say no, because, for instance, when it gets colder out, we have a lot of individuals who will start their cars, and those cars will get started with the keys in them, and they're unoccupied. They get stolen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We had that problem in the Northeast that happened beginning in October. We went to the community. We said, please, don't leave your car running. Go out there and scrape your window, scrape your cars off. And our stolen auto reduction happened almost immediately. Mm-hmm. Of individuals actually saying, okay, I'm not going to have my car stolen.
Right.
So the proof is already there that the community listens to what we recommend, and then, you know, we will constantly keep changing to what the community needs.
You know, I say this, Major, as you well know, a few years ago, there was a dramatic drop in homicides in Kansas City, Missouri, citywide, and that came in the wake of these different initiatives like KC Nova that had been started, and suddenly everybody was saying, hey, look at the impact these programs can have. And then a year later, the numbers spiked, and the year after that, the numbers spiked again. So you just begin to wonder about cause and effect and impacts here.
Exactly. That's why this is so important to me and for my officers that work at East Patrol, is that this is community-based. This
yeah.
is a community request, and we bow down to the whole fact that they want us to be there. And so we're there with them. We're
okay.
there with them throughout this.
We'll leave our conversation there. That's Major Greg Volker, Division Commander for the East Patrol Division, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Brian Stalder is President of the Indian Mound Neighborhood Association. Andrea Tuthope brought this story to us here at KCUR. Thank you all for a good conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about good kids' books just in time for the holidays. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Plans to revitalize the neighborhoods east of Troost are approved, but what changes will residents actually see? You can hear the answer and other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Next week, 6x10. That's the average size of a cell used for solitary confinement. Too many Americans face the mental and physical effects from time spent in solitary. We explore their stories and the practice of solitary confinement. And we need to alert you to a correction to yesterday's weekend to-do list. The information regarding the KC Streetcar Holiday Jam was incorrect, but we do have the correct times and performances listed in the online version of the list, so go to kcur.org for that. Well, with winter break right around the corner for so many school kids in the area, meaning they'll have time on their hands in a few days to do some reading, it's time for one of our biannual kids' book shows. We've gathered our Johnson County librarians once again to run down some of the best books they've come across this year, and we'll read a few excerpts along the way, and just maybe you'll get some gift ideas out of this segment as well. Our librarians are Debbie McLeod. She's a librarian emeritus. Debbie, always good to have you here.
Hi,
welcome.
Steve.
Elena McVicker is a youth collections librarian. Elena, welcome back.
Thank you.
Bradley Debrick is the early literacy specialist. Bradley, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Elena, let's start with you, and what better way to start than with a book titled Peanut Butter and Jelly by Ben Clanton.
Yeah, this book is excellent. It's third in a series. It's a graphic novel series.
You need three books to talk about peanut butter and jelly?
Yeah,
is that
right.
Where we're
well,
going
it
here?
Takes yeah. three books to work up to peanut butter and jelly,
okay.
apparently.
Yeah.
It's perfect for emerging readers, kids just ready to tackle chapter books.
Cool.
But still want a little fun and whimsy in there. And it's about, it follows a narwhal and a jellyfish and their best friends. And the narwhal is obsessed with waffles.
Yeah.
And in this book, he sees Jelly eating a peanut butter cookie and thinks it's a waffle. And so Jelly convinces him to try it, and then he becomes obsessed with peanut butter and wants to change his name.
I have a lot of thoughts about peanut butter and jelly, and it just
yeah.
seems to me that one of the real tricks here is that you put too much peanut butter on the sandwich, and that just crushes it. The jelly won't get you across the finish line.
I also have strong opinions about peanut butter, and my opinion is I'm not a big fan of it.
Because?
I don't know. I never liked the taste as a kid.
Yeah.
But this book presents
I like it with celery.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes. It works. Yeah.
Well, there's no celery in this book.
Yeah. Well, we need to do a fourth book on peanut butter
there
and jelly.
There is going to be a fourth book and in the spring. And Narwhal and Jelly discover a friend who's an otter. And Ben
right?
Clanton writes and illustrates these books, and his illustrations are so cute and funny. So I highly recommend picking this graphic novel series up for the younger kids in your life.
Peanut Butter and Jelly is the title of the book, the author Ben Clanton. Debbie, let's talk about Tactile Hill Squad by Daniel Jose Older.
Yes, this is the first book of a series, and I think it's going to be very popular. It's, okay, you're back in Civil War days.
We're still talking series. Every book's a series these days.
Yeah.
It didn't used to be that way.
Well, no. I mean, there were some series that you had that Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys, Bobbsey Twins,
yes.
That kind of thing.
Right.
But there's just been an awful lot because kids, I think because our society is so mobile, you can have these kids or these characters follow you no matter where you go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this gives some stability to kids in their lives. So, and they you know, this is a friend for them.
Yes.
You know, it's
absolutely. I totally get that.
It's great. But this book is, I mean, think of the Civil War and all the stuff that happened in that and dinosaurs.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes, oh, really?
General Lee's taking on a pterodactyl? Is that what we're talking
about here? No. Instead of horses, everybody uses dinosaurs to get around. Like, you have brachiosauruses that are like your buses.
Okay.
You have triceratops that are like your cart horses. You have raptors that are like the fast speed, you know. It's just amazing. And this
this works in this book?
Yeah, kind of.
In a way.
Yeah, kind of in a way. But I think it's so weird that I think kids will like it. And the characters in the book are African Americans. They are residents of the Colored Orphan Asylum. And they're either orphans or they have been put there by their parents because in this universe, the only people fighting for the North, I mean, besides the officers and generals, but the common soldier, they are Blacks, African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of kids are put into this orphan and asylum. And it takes place in Manhattan, an mm-hmm. alternative Manhattan. And what happens is Magdalise, who is the main character, she gets a letter saying that her brother Montez has been injured and she wants to go to him. But then all these riots start happening in Manhattan because a draft notice has been set out because they need to have some of the white citizens now go and fight the war against the South. So you have these riots in Manhattan. You have this these orphans being endangered. And then on top of this, Magdalise finds out that she can telepathically communicate with the dinosaurs.
Oh.
I know.
There's the big twist we're looking for there. Yeah.
So, but, and this is crazy because the dactyls are pterodactyls. And what they do is they run along the roof and they leap on the backs of these pterodactyls who are hanging out on the rooftops. And they go flying around and do these things, spy missions and all that stuff. It's crazy.
So what you're saying is I can be a children's book author if I let my imagination just go crazy wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what this book
is. And
as
long as it's
like.
Well written, it's okay. But I mean, there's some stuff in here. There's some mashups. I mean, even some of the language in here is kind of modern. I mean, I don't know if maybe they did say cool back in the 1860s, but I do think because it's pretty well action-packed and throwing the dinosaurs, I mean, crazy.
And telepathy, you can do
all
this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't you like to have done that?
It never crossed my mind. Dactyl Hill Squad is the book. Daniel Jose Older is the author for grades, 4 through 7, it sounds like?
I'd say 4 through 6. I think 7th graders would say, oh, this is a little, I'll go to something else.
Okay. Bradley Debrick, let's go to a book titled Dreamers.
Yes, Dreamers by Gigi Morales. She is a Mexican-American author-illustrator, very proud of her heritage, and this particular book chronicles her immigration to the United States with her toddler son. I think kids have heard the word dreamers in various contexts recently,
right.
And this is an excellent lap book to share with a preschooler or kindergarten or first grader to kind of explain how people may be dreaming of a different life or of a better life or just something different. Gigi is so deliberate in her illustrations. There's so much symbolism and hidden things and meanings as you look through this to talk about. And she peppers her language with a few Spanish words that really kind of tie back to her culture and the pride she has in being from Mexico, the family she left behind. The turning point in Dreamers is when she walks into the San Francisco Public Library. library. Hmm. And she sees this universe of stories and books and people there to help. And she has obviously hidden throughout the book, titles of other picture books that inspired her and that she shared with her son as he was growing up as a new American.
Neat. Yeah. Neat book, it sounds
like. It's a great book.
The illustrations
are phenomenal. It's getting a lot of talk as a potential Caldecott honor or winner for this year. So the illustrations are something you just want to pore over again and again.
So like there's buzz for Caldecott's, like there's buzz for the Oscars.
There is, and it starts early on.
No kidding.
This book has been on most every list that I've seen.
The book, again, is Dreamers. It's for preschool through third grade.
Perhaps, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Elena, let's go to a book, Blood, Water, Paint by Joy McCullough.
Yeah, this book is for teens. It's
older kids.
It's a historical fiction. It takes place in Renaissance Italy and follows Artemisia Gentilecci. She is a painter. Her dad, however, her father is taking credit for all of her work. Because, of course, back then women didn't have a lot of social capital. They couldn't own property and money, and all of that was kind of tied up. So she was painting beautiful paintings. Her dad was taking credit. She lost her mother at a young age, and so Artemisia's story is told in verse, beautiful verse. And then she recalls her mother used to tell her stories about women in the Bible from their perspective, and that part is told in prose. And so I think we have someone who's going to read.
Yes, we do.
And this part is the mother's story. So the mother is telling the story to Artemisia, and it is about Judith. And if you don't quite remember the story of Judith, her homeland is being invaded by Assyrians. And she's frustrated by the lack of movement in the war. And so she is going to take matters into her own hands. And we also hear from her servant, Abra.
Okay, Sophia Gillespie is going to read a little bit. She's a Central Standard intern. The book again, Blood, Water, Paint.
Abra resumes her stitching as Judith resumes her rant. The pinprick of a moment before is forgotten as a much deeper stab of worry slices through Abra's heart. Judith isn't only outraged. Judith is planning something. There are things she can do as a woman, Judith insists, that no man would think of, much less pull off. When Judith finally takes a breath, Abra sets aside her mending. Leave me out of it. Perhaps the world has taught Abra she has nothing to offer but mending, cooking, and cleaning. But Judith must do this thing that's only just beginning to take shape in her mind, because she is not small. She is not weak. She will never, ever be feeble-minded. And above all, she is outraged. The world will tell you not to be outraged, love. They will tell you to sit quietly, be kind, be a lady. And when they do, be Judith instead.
Hmm. Sophia Gillespie reading from Blood, Water, Paint. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, Debbie, we're reviewing some of the best new children's books out on the market just in the wake before the holidays here. Maybe some good ideas for gifts with our guests from the Johnson County Public Library. Debbie, let's talk about Saving Winslow here by Sharon Creech.
Yes, this is Sharon's latest book, and it tells the story of Louis, who his father happens to bring home this newborn donkey. The mother is ill and cannot take care of the donkey, so his uncle has given it to his father to do whatever they want with it. And everyone thinks this little donkey is going to die. But Louis is determined nothing will happen to this little creature. And what's great about this book is that it can be read by an independent reader for someone who's just transitioning from chapter books, but it's a great read aloud for somebody. And what Danny's going to read will get you into the mood.
Okay, Danny Alexander, our producer here at UpToDate, reading from Saving Winslow.
Louis knelt beside the basket. A small gray head with black eyes and feathery eyelashes and sticking up ears emerged. Attached to the head was a trembling thin body and four long spindly legs, all of it covered in splotchy gray fur scattered with brown freckles. It was not a dog or a cat. It was a pitiful-looking thing, and it was gazing at Louis. He felt a sudden rush, as if the roof had peeled off the house and the sun had dived into every corner of the kitchen. "A goat?" he asked, kneeling beside the basket. "No, a donkey," his father said. "A mini-donkey born last night." "A mini-donkey?" Louis' hand cupped the donkey's head, patting it gently. The donkey seemed too weak to move. "Something's wrong with it." "The mother is sick, can't take care of it." "Poor mama," Louis said. "Poor baby. What will happen to it?" "Probably go downhill fast, might last a day or two." "No! So his mother said, "Why do you have the donkey? Why did you bring it home if it might just die in a day or two?" "I don't know," his father said. "I felt sorry for it. I thought maybe we could at least watch it until it, you know, until it dies." He whispered that last word. The donkey made a small noise that sounded like, "Please." Louis lifted the donkey from the basket and held it close. It smelled of wet hay. It put its face against Louis's neck and made that noise again. "Please." "Okay," Louis said, "I accept the mission." "What mission?" "To save this pitiful, motherless donkey."
Hmm. Danny Alexander reading from Saving Winslow, the author Sharon Creech, recommended for grades 3 through 6. Okay, Bradley, let's go to a book here, A House That Once Was.
House That Once Was is written by Julie Foliano and illustrated by Lane Smith. And I haven't found very many books this year that where the illustration and the text work so perfectly in harmony. Mm. Both Foliano's poetry and Smith's illustrations could stand on their own as a storytelling device. But when you put them together, it creates this book experience that as an early literacy person, I want every child to have. I want that whole enveloping, encompassing experience in the book.
Right.
The story or the poem that Foliano writes is about two children who find an abandoned house that is sort of returning to nature that's been left in the woods nearby. And if you can get past the breaking and entering that the kids do to explore, they sort of imagine who once lived there.
Hmm. We're going to have Dan Margulies, one of our reporters here at KCUR, read from the book, A House That Once Was. And I should point out it's for grades preschool through grade two, it sounds like.
Yes.
Dan.
At the front of the house that is waiting, there's a door that is not really open, but barely. A door that is closed, but not quite. A door that is stuck between coming and going. A door that was once painted white. Off to the side, there's a window that's watching, a window that once opened wide, a window that now has no window at all, a window that says, "Climb inside." Inside the house, it is silent but creaking. We're whispering mostly, but not really speaking. We whisper, though no one would mind if we didn't. The someone who once was is someone who isn't. The someone who once was is gone. Who was this someone who ate beans for dinner, who sat by this fire, who looked in this mirror? Who was this someone whose books have been waiting, whose bed is still made, whose pictures are fading? Who was this someone who walked down this hallway, who cooked in this kitchen, who napped in this chair? Who was this someone who left without packing? Someone who's gone, but is still everywhere.
Hmm. Dan Margulies reading from the book, A House That Once Was. Sounds like a good book.
It's an excellent book. Excellent choice.
And Dan's even raving about it here. Yeah, sounds good. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're running through kind of a survey of new kids' books that have come out this year, some very good ones. We're joined by a trio of experts from the Johnson County Public Library. Elena, let's go to Sadie by Courtney Summers, a book for grades 9 and up.
Yeah, this book, if you have any teens or friends in your life who are obsessed with true crime podcasts like Serial or Up and Vanished, this would be an excellent book to give to them. It follows Wes McCrae. He has a podcast called The Girls, and he's asked to investigate the disappearance of Sadie. And Sadie disappeared after her younger sister was murdered. And so Wes's story is told through podcast transcripts. And when you read the transcripts, you can hear exactly how it sounds in your head, how the podcast, how they talk, how they speak. And so Wes is following Sadie. Sadie's following the killer. And things kind of come full circle. And then I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't want to give away sort of the ending. But yeah, if you have true crime obsessed people in your life, I highly recommend giving them this book.
Sadie by Courtney Summers. Are you seeing any different trends, Debbie, in the books that you're looking at this year? I mean, we're seeing more series books. Is it hard? Is the quality of the books sort of going up? The books you're raving about here, you guys are so high end, so many of these books today.
I see a lot of creativity. I see a lot of mashups as far as styles. I see a lot of mix of poetry and prose.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've had several of those here today.
And there's one, Matt Phelan just did a book about The Night and the Dinosaurs, and it's a mix-up of the prose and graphic novel. But then again, Dave Pilkey has been doing that such a long time with Captain Underpants.
Right.
You know, you do have just, the bounds are just endless, I think. Mm-hmm. And a book that I don't know whether we'll get to later on that I'm going to talk about, but The Assassination of Brangwyne Spurge, it's real interesting with the points of views and how one point of view is told through the illustrations and one is done in text, which is similar to Hugo Cabré, The Invention of Hugo Cabré, but not really, because it's dealing with different points of view, while Hugo Cabré just took scenes from the story, and either it was in text or it was in illustration.
That strikes me as such a risk to do something like
that. It is. It either works or it doesn't.
Yeah,
And you just don't know. With Brangwyne, it was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's amazing to see the different ways that books are being made, and also in illustration. It's just so much more open. But then again, I don't know how. Sometimes it helps if you are a known entity, because publishers, of course, want to make money.
Right. Right.
But with the internet now and with self-published books, you have a lot of things that can come out that way, and so it's just endless.
I'm just wondering, Elena, as you open up a new book, how long does it take you before you begin to think, oh, this is really a good book versus one that sort of you begin to have questions about?
I am kind of a snap judgment kind of person. I've read so many and...
I was going to say, you would know.
Yeah, you can kind of feel like which ones are special, a little more special than others. It doesn't take long, although I will admit there are some that I've had colleagues and friends push at me and be like, you need to read this a second time. And sometimes I almost like them better if it takes a little work to get into it.
Oh, that's
but generally, yeah, you can. Bloodwater Paint was one of them. I had a colleague shove that at me. He's like, you need to read this right now. And as soon as I sat down and read it, I could tell, like, this book is special. It's going to be on some award lists.
Yeah.
Or it should be.
Bradley, how about you? How long does it take you to figure something out?
My specialty and my training is really with picture books. And I have a very specific process that I go through to when I get a new picture book. I check the cover, I check the back, I check the end papers, and then I just look at the illustration. I don't look at the words at all. Second pass, I read the words, and then the third pass, I go back and I combine everything and make sure that it melds together in my head. So I have a really specific process. Elena and Debbie can speak to the chapter books and teen novels, but I am a picture book person, and I've got that down.
What are you looking for when you look at illustrators only, the illustrations only?
To make sure that everything is in perspective, to make sure there's a sense of continuity and line that encourages you to turn the page. You want that motivation to turn the page and see what's next. I check for cultural references. I check for, there was a book not long ago that was set in 1944, but yet it showed an American flag with 50 stars. And those kinds of incongruences and issues that the illustrator puts in those books, I find those things and they weigh heavy on
you. Know,
me.
If I was a children's author, I'm not sure I'd want my book to go before Bradley Debrick. You know, I think I'd be a little nervous about that.
Well, I sat on the Caldecott Award Committee in 2015.
Oh,
and,
really?
And so the books that we reviewed, 400-plus titles, that's the kind of scrutiny that you go through every one. And I can no longer look at a picture book with just a sense of awe. I always look at it with a sense of a reviewer.
Yeah.
So it's changed my perspective.
It does. Yeah, it definitely does change your perspective.
Do you miss the old way? Do you miss that sense of wonder? Because that's what makes it cool and fun.
I do, but I get that when I share it with a kid. When I go out and I do a story time at a preschool or at one of our libraries and I see those kids looking at the book in the way that I'm sharing it through their eyes, I still get that sense of awe and wonder and fun because I'm watching their eyes look back at me. I've processed it a different way, but I'm still getting that from the feedback from them.
Will kids tell you, will they indicate to you whether a book is, are they good barometers or do kids like everything?
They are excellent barometers.
Oh, really?
You can tell sometimes just non-verbally the way they're responding or not responding to something. It's always a big risk when you take a brand new story into a story time for preschoolers. And I will tell them that, you know, this may be an awful choice, but I want to try it and see what you think. And then at the flip side, then we talk about what did they see, what did they notice. because if what they saw is what I wanted them to see, I feel like it was a successful read.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Someone else was going to jump in here. Debbie, I cut you off.
Oh, well, it's no big deal, but I can still have that sense of awe because I look at it part as an artist and looking at something and go, wow. You know, I hope this lives up to my expectations. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
And sometimes you have an artist or illustrator that you adore
right.
from previous, and their new work just isn't the quality that you expect.
Right.
And that's disappointing, but it's a filter that you're looking right. through towards that illustrator's work.
And as far as like with chapter books, you can, when they come back to you and they say, I want another one like this, it just says something that somehow they have connected. And really, you know, teaching children's literature, I point this out to my students too. And to see their wonder, I mean, these are, you know, adults, and to see the wonder in their eyes when they are acquainted with these children's books and young adult books, I feel like I'm doing my mission. I'm accomplishing something.
I bet you guys get that question a lot. I want one just like this one.
Yeah, for sure. We at Johnson County, we get a lot of readers' advisory questions, and our staff is excellent at interpreting and finding new books. My favorite thing to do is just to go to the stacks to see what we had on our shelves, because our collection floats. So sometimes the same books that were there yesterday are not there today. So my favorite thing to go is to go to the stacks, hand the kids a couple books, and you really do get a feel for what's popular that way. And I think as librarians, we're really good at, like, I could tell you this book is critically amazing but might not be as popular with kids. Or, like, this book is amazing because it is popular with kids but definitely probably won't win any awards.
Mm-hmm. That's it has to connect with your inner child.
Yeah.
That's one thing. If you are evaluating children's books, you have to always maintain that sense of wonder.
Right.
You can't, I mean, I can be just as cynical as the next person. But with children's books, you have to see how the author creates the character and the setting and everything. And if you can go, wow, yeah, or you can connect. But you have to have some openness inside of you to allow this to happen too.
Yeah. Well, let's do just a few more books here before we lose our time. Debbie, let's go to Blue, a book for kindergarten through grade 3.
Right. This is by Laura Vaccaro Seeger, who her husband is the grandson of Pete Seeger.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Anyway, but she did a previous book called Green, where she took the color green and did various shades of it. It was more of a concept kind of thing. But with Blue, what she's done is she's told a story in this. And the way she does her illustrations is she has little die cuts. And when they work on both sides of the page, the way she places it. But what this tells is the story. The very first page, it says Baby Blue. And you see this little infant and a little puppy. And as the pages progress, it not only covers things like midnight blue or, you know, different shades of blue, but you can see the puppy and the boy growing up.
Mm.
And towards the end of the book, you can see where this is going, and you see old blue, and then you say feeling blue. And it recognizes that colors can relate emotions.
Yeah, that sounds good. The book again, Blue by Laura Vaccaro Seeger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I appreciate all our good guests here from the Johnson County Public Library. We'll have all our recommendations, their recommendations, even the ones we didn't have time to talk about on air. They'll be on our website later today, kcur.org/up-to-date. I want to thank Bradley Debrick, Elena McVicker, and Debbie McLeod, all from the Johnson County Public Library. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve.
Next week, the holidays mean music, family, and, of course, spending money. Our smart money experts are back to discuss holiday bonuses and how to spend them. What is a holiday bonus? We had help this week from Steven Steigman, Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. Today is Emily Reed's last day here with Up to Date. She's been our wonderful intern this semester, and we appreciated her help so much. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are Up to Date. Oh,